giving up on this car. God, I was trying. I worked every day until 7 p.m. and then raced over to my second job at CVS, where I worked as a cashier until midnight. One time at that job, my manager came up to me. "You do your makeup so nicely. Do you want to work in the beauty department?" "Well," I said, "if I have to work solely on commission, no, that gives me anxiety." I just didn't want to have to try to upsell anybody to make more money. "No, no," she said, "we'd pay you more." Sold. So I was in the beauty department at CVS when this super nice man, Michael Levine, came in looking for something. I always liked when customers asked me for help because it was as if we were on a hunt for something together. When we got to talking, as you can guess, I got to talking with all my customers, and I told him I was an actress, but I worked in an agency. "Oh, why don't you come to the TV Land Awards?" "What do you mean?" "I produce the show," he said. I confess, I didn't know what the heck that meant at that point. "Oh, okay. It's in an airplane hangar in Santa Monica Airport. Sally Field is going to do a bit about the Flying Nun." "Oh, I love Sally Field," I said. "I really, really love her." So I and my life support car went to the TV Land Awards. I brought my friend Julia, who was another client of my manager. My manager was going back and forth between Florida and LA, bringing in new waves of talent. As we pulled up to the show, Julia was still changing her clothes in the car because she had just gotten off her waitressing shift. The moment I started wondering if we dressed fancy enough, we got in the valet line right behind Morgan frickin' Freeman. All his movies flashed before my eyes. Shawshank, Seven, Driving Miss Daisy. Julia and I got out, and I was just beyond excited to be sharing this time and space with an acting legend. Mr. Morgan Freeman, because I can't just call him Morgan, was walking right in front of us when the valet started yelling for me. "Miss, miss," he said, "your car won't start." I turned. Mr. Morgan Freeman turned. The whole world turned as my car held up the arrivals at an award show. "Just shimmy it," I yelled back. "You gotta try 14 times. I mimed it for him. "Just go like boom, boom, boom." "What do you mean? Just try it." It worked. I tell ya, you gotta do what you gotta do. I was shimmying the ignition of my own life, trying to get it moving. My next attempt to break through was auditioning for American Idol that July. My friend Dakota was another client of my manager and was really one of the most talented singers I had ever heard. I always tried to encourage and support her, but I don't think she quite believed in herself at that point. We were talking about auditioning together, but she decided it just wasn't for her. I wasn't going to give up so easily. And besides, what did I have to lose? The closest audition was in San Diego at the Qualcomm Stadium, which was then home to the San Diego Chargers. Marty and I drove all the way down there, waiting in line forever because there were 12,000 people trying out. They had us all sit as though we were watching a football game, doing sing-alongs to songs like What Else? California Dreamin'. We were there for 8 hours, with the sun beating down on us the whole time. They had a cameraman walking around and eventually walked over to me. "What can you tell us about the day?" he asked. "Two words. Two things I'm going to tell you," I said. "Sun, screen." Yes, I know that's one word, but I could barely think. I was wearing a jean skirt and was getting third-degree burns on my shins. My number was finally called, and I made my way down to the field. They had about 20 tents set up with 2 to 3 judges per tent. The handlers lined up the folks who were auditioning in rows of 5, and you had literally 30 seconds to sing whatever you had prepared. I decided to sing Heavy from Dreamgirls because I thought it was appropriate, but also fun and different. I was in the middle with 2 people on either side of me. The girl right before me sang Cruisin' and did a great job. I sang my bit, and the guy who I could tell was the lead judge just said, "Okay." The next 2 people sang, and then we waited to find out if one of us was going to get that coveted yellow piece of paper that meant we'd advance to the next round. "You know," the guy started stretching it out, "this year we're really taking it to the next level, and there are some people you just know are making up stuff to say, stringing words together that amount to nothing. This was that guy. And I just don't know if you guys have the next level of talent that we need." Well, I think you're wrong, I said. Everybody looked at me like I had grown a second head. One of the girls blurted out, well? Excuse me, said the guy. I just think you're wrong, I repeated. I think you're making a terrible choice. I owned it. In that moment, I stood up for myself. There were two female judges in the tent right next to ours. The guy's excuse me had echoed so loudly they turned to watch our little show. One of the women, a blonde, looked right at me. Come here, she said, come here. I marched over to their tent, not sure if this woman just wanted to put me in my place or what. Sing for me, she said. Audition for me. If he said no, audition for me. There were two people left in her group of five waiting to sing. I turned to them and said, sorry for cutting, and I thought, okay, here goes. And I began to sing my heart out. She said when I was done. She gave the guy judge a what are you thinking look, and she gave me that yellow piece of paper. Thank you, I said. I looked back up to where Marty was sitting and waved my little yellow ticket at him. He jumped up screaming and ran down the bleachers to get closer to me. He had been right there, sitting in that sun with me and for me. And I was and remain so grateful for his support. I was one of about 250 people picked that day. The officials took me back to the corral where they took all of my information and acted like I'd signed my life away. Like this was the Hunger Games or something. This was just at the dawn of social media, and they told us that if we had any social handles that we had to delete them immediately. Can you imagine? About 3 weeks later, there were the second round auditions at a hotel back in Los Angeles. We were in the banquet halls, and the place was completely mobbed. I was feeling good, so excited. Then I started to look around. Why is that girl in a bikini? Why was that guy dressed like a clown? There were people here who were just trying to get on TV. They asked me to learn a song, Gwen Stefani's The Sweet Escape, to do on camera before I went in for my actual audition. There's a tricky rap sing part in that tune, but that worked in my favor because your girl here loves some hip-hop. I wondered whether they were seeing if I could pull it off or trying to embarrass me. Probably a little of both. Once that was done, I went in for the real audition. It was held in a massive room packed with 30 crew members. There were tons of lights and tons of cameras. Oh, I said, oh, dear. The judges were two executive producers of American Idol, Nigel Lithgow and Simon Fuller. So, you're a talent agent, said Simon, the British clip of his voice sounding so much like Simon Cowell's. They even looked alike. Yeah, then you must know what talent is, said Nigel, who was also English. Yes, I do. I told them I was going to sing Heavy, and they nodded. Good choice, said Simon. But I was about 5 seconds into when Nigel started yelling, hold on, hold on. I froze, and he said, why are you stomping your foot? I didn't think I was. I was just getting into it. Yeah, I thought you were supposed to know what talent is, Nigel sniffed. I knew what he was doing. I'd watched the show enough to know that they were degrading me to try to get a rise out of me. The cameras were rolling, and fiery contestants or Down in Flames auditions made good television. Yeah, I don't know that I like the sound of your voice, said Simon. I nodded. He was entitled to his opinion. Yeah, I don't think you know how to use it yet, said Nigel. Oh, yeah, okay, I said. And that's it, said Simon. Okay, parroted Nigel. If you don't think I'm ready or right, then thank you for this opportunity, I said. I started to walk away when they were sputtering as if they couldn't believe I was folding so easily. Thank you so much for your time, I said. I walked out the door, and of course the camera was right in my face. There was a host there who I should add was no Ryan Seacrest, and he asked me, do you think they made a bad decision? It's their decision and a matter of opinion, I said. But I'm glad I had the experience. I started to walk away and they followed me. I turned around. For the record, guys, I said, I'm not going to give you any good television so you don't have to follow me anymore. The cameraman turned around on a dime. I had learned a lesson. I had advocated for myself at the Qualcomm Stadium because I really, really wanted that opportunity. But once I'd had a better sense of what the process was all about, I realized it wasn't something I wanted to fight for. American Idol wasn't the dream for me, and I don't want anyone thinking I'm a hater. I feel those shows have the power to help an artist become him or herself, but looking back, I'm at peace with not getting on the show. After years of the 14 shimmy method, my Ford Focus met its final resting place in a car accident on Wilshire Boulevard. A guy who was late for an interview at a talent management company, so LA, I know, came across the entire road and hit me on the passenger side. I was so scared because I was about an inch away from being seriously injured. Life, as John Lennon said, is what happens to you when you are busy making other plans. He was a kid and he did everything he could to try to get out of reporting the accident to the police and his insurance company. I called Marty from the side of the road and he came and met me. That stupid kid was on his way to be some stupid assistant for some stupid management company, I said. He can't even watch where the hell he's going. There was such violence in my voice that Marty looked at me like I was crazy. I took a deep breath. I'm just angry and scared, I said. This poor kid was just trying to get to an interview and he's running late, so he was driving irresponsibly. He made a mistake. Years later, I ended up with a manager who worked at the office where the kid was going for an interview. I would always look for him, and I honestly hope he got the job. Michael Levine and I would meet again years after our first encounter. In December 2017, I was back at the Barker Airplane Hangar in Santa Monica, this time for the Critics' Choice Awards. This Is Us was up for two awards, and the whole cast was there all dressed up. I was so excited. We were on the red carpet when I suddenly heard someone yell my name. It was Michael. What are you here for? I asked. I was thrilled to see him again. I'm producing the awards, he said. Chrissy, do you believe all of this? You were at CVS. I know. Believe me, I know. I was in a CVS parking lot at midnight praying my car would start so I could get home and sleep before getting up at 7 a.m. to start my other work day. You just never know when it's going to click for you. If you're having hard times right now, whatever shimmy trick you have to do to keep going, take a mental picture. I want you to look back on this part of your life and thank yourself for not giving up. 10. If nothing changes, nothing changes. I don't blame Sly, I swear. It was a Friday in September, the night before my 30th birthday party. Marty and I went to the Arclight movie theater in L.A. to see Sylvester Stallone in The Expendables. There are about a million gunshots in the movie, and I'm not sure if it was the sound or the darkness. But suddenly, I began to have heart palpitations, like I was about to die. Babe, something's wrong, I whispered to Marty. My heart is beating out of my chest. He helped me out of the dark of the theater, and I sat on the bench in the lobby. My heart was still racing, and I just felt out of control, barely able to breathe. People were staring at me. I must have looked awful because Marty looked scared. I'm calling an ambulance, he said. He dialed 911 and they came right away with a stretcher. The EMTs were three incredibly nice men, but I felt so vulnerable and embarrassed. They put the stretcher on the ground and asked me to lie down on it. What if they can't lift me, I thought. What if I'm too heavy? They took me away in the ambulance with Marty holding my hand on the way to the nearest hospital. I was admitted immediately and had an EKG and all these other tests with abbreviations I didn't understand. Words were thrown at me that I just nodded at. A young physician came into my room. Well, you didn't have a heart attack, he said. There's also no sign of stroke. Oh, okay, I said, relieved but bewildered. We're going to do a stress test and the whole gamut to make sure everything is fine. You have really good numbers. There's nothing wrong with your triglycerides and your cholesterol is fine. Okay, I said. But you'll want to lose weight. Yeah. The attending doctor came in, shaking her head. The first thing she said was, you know, if you were my daughter, I would force you to get a gastric bypass. She was my age and she talked to me like I was a child. Seriously, she said. Okay, thanks, I said, thinking, awesome. Thanks for your bedside manner. Thank you for your unsolicited opinion. She wanted me to stay there for observation, so Marty canceled the birthday party he had planned. My friends and I were going to have dinner at a restaurant, then do cake and presents afterward at my house. We let everyone know it was canceled, and I called my family. I stayed 2 nights and most of Sunday. The Saturday doctor came into my room, and I could immediately tell she was kinder than Dr. Borish Bypass. I smoothed the sheets as if I were hosting a guest. "We did a whole workup," she said, "and everything is fine. Do you have a history of panic attacks or anxiety?" "No," I said, like there was something wrong with that. "Well, it appears you had a severe anxiety attack." "Hmm," I said. I had no idea anxiety could feel like dying. "Chrissy," she said, leaning in, "is there past trauma that you haven't dealt with?" "What are you talking about?" I said, feigning shock. I was so delusional, so clueless about my own life and my body. "No." That night in the hospital, I thought about what the doctor had said. Anxiety is one of the worst things you can experience in your whole life. And the more you resist, the more it persists. I learned pretty quickly that I had to lean into my anxiety and accept it, or try to. I had a much-needed conversation with myself. What's the worst thing in the world that could happen? I asked myself out loud. "I could die," I answered. "Okay, you're right," I conceded. "And that's not the end of the world. It's just not. I don't believe death is forever." I had to surrender control. Whatever happens, happens. The thing is, I could die, but I just didn't want to. Let's say it was a process. When I got out of the hospital, I was worried that something was really wrong with me physically and that they didn't catch it. They had prescribed Xanax, but honestly, I think I only ever took half a pill. I didn't want any part of it. There were some nights when I would cry myself to sleep, with poor Marty just having to watch me, unable to comfort me. I felt like such a failure that he had seen me that way. And he felt like a failure because he couldn't help me. I was scared. And the only thing that I could really do was try to lose weight. I was definitely my heaviest weight ever during this time. I made it a point to thank God that nothing was wrong, and I had the ability to change it. I went on a 2,000-calorie diet, and Marty and I walked every night for 20 minutes. No gastric bypass, and nothing extreme. In 4 months, I lost 90 pounds, and I felt great. Marty was helpful on the diet and never tried to sabotage me. But then, losing weight got hard again. I told my friend I couldn't do it on my own anymore. I was falling back into old patterns. She told me I should start going to a support group. I found one that was held in a place I passed by every morning. But honestly, it was like I had magically arrived right where I needed to be. I was just suddenly walking through the door. It was a square room with a circle of chairs. I had an orange bucket bag from Michael Kors, and I put it down on the seat next to me with a sigh. "Oh, God," I thought, "it's come to this." I stayed completely quiet at my first group meeting, just listening, but what I heard really resonated. Once you stop making everything about yourself and your feelings, things just kind of click. You're forced to be honest with what's going on with you deep down and what you're doing to yourself. People told stories, and it was like they were describing my life. I heard stories about things that I thought only I did and felt shameful for, like not being able to wait for the food to be cooked in the microwave and eating the burrito that is still half frozen, or throwing food away in the trash can in your house but contemplating digging it out because it's on the top and it hasn't touched anything else. I've done that too. You go out to lunch, but all you can think about is what you're having for dinner, the next meal. I really did think that I was the only person who thought that way. And this wasn't about the joy of food, but the need to fill the void and eat our emotions. Most of the people were hilarious, wonderful, smart people. "Oh, we've almost got it together," I thought, looking around. "We have these successful lives and relationships, but there's this huge component that's not locking in yet." Then there were those of us who were just a mess and simply couldn't function. I never thought I was better than any person because I didn't eat a whole loaf of bread at one time. Not to say I couldn't, I just haven't. I sympathize with those folks so deeply. It doesn't matter how addiction manifests. Addiction is addiction is addiction. Whether you're a drug addict or a food addict, it's the same thing. It's just that food is easily accessible and acceptable. and you have to consume it in order to survive. That was really, that was hard for me to realize that I had such an obsession with food that the feeling it gave me was an addiction. I kept going back. My third week, a gentleman sidled up to me during the coffee break. "I noticed you last week," he said with a slight Brooklyn accent. "And then I noticed your really great purse." "Thank you," I said, unconsciously putting my hand up to push back my hair and showing my wedding ring. "I'm gay," he staged whispered. He was so funny, and I loved that he had a little edge to him. He was definitely a man who spoke his mind, which, of course, I admired. Before too long, I learned he was also an actor. We became very close friends, and I started to look forward to seeing him at the support group because I didn't feel alone. Initially, I went once a week, but I became obsessive. Once a week, then twice, then three times, and then I found a meeting to go to every morning. I could tell Marty resented how much attending group was taking over my life. Our life. "I don't see why you can spend an hour in a support group and not in the gym," he said a couple of times. I felt my food obsession was a symptom, not the issue. And I knew I needed to fix the mental stuff before I could hope to have a lasting relationship with my body. I became a mirror to Marty, forcing him to examine his own stuff. He began to exercise more, and when we put the food down, we realized we just didn't have much in common. The more we started focusing on ourselves as individuals, the more the wedge between us grew. He never wanted to do yoga with me, and I never wanted to hike with him. Even though it's okay for couples to not always be together, it felt like we were actively choosing to spend time apart and using our schedules as an excuse for what was really happening. It was scary to realize this. In a perfect world, we would have had time to talk and work on our relationship. But I was working so hard, usually about 70 to 80 hours a week. And when you're an agent, you have to make yourself 100% available to your clients, because you never know what's going to happen. I got home so late that by the time I had a minute to take a breath, it was time to go to work again. With a group meeting first, mind you. There was such a feeling of camaraderie. I was probably a month in when a guy came over and told me about a retreat being held at a campground near Palm Springs, and he said he could get me a free ticket. Yes. It really was like camp, where you shared bunk beds and everything. The retreat was led by Sherry Meager, who was thin and blonde and put together. Such a cute little thing. "Don't let this fool you," she said. "I used to weigh nearly 300 pounds. Now I dye my hair, use spray tan, and I put makeup on." She was so open about her vulnerabilities that it set the tone for the weekend. "None of us are perfect," she said. I soaked it all up like a sponge. One of our activities at camp was called Drop the Rock. For this, we were led into the middle of a forest to find a rock. Everything that you want to let go of, you allow to flow into that rock. Then, when you drop it, or throw it, all the feelings and emotions that are holding you back stay in that forest. We also had to write a letter to our future selves, with the understanding that Sherry would mail them to us exactly 1 year later. "You're special just for being alive," I wrote. "You've got this. You can do this. Take it one day at a time. Take it 1 hour at a time." I told myself to remember all that I had come through so far in my life. I had overcome 5 elementary schools, my parents' divorce, the abuse of my stepfather, and no longer being the baby, and I managed to scrape a life together on my own 2 feet in Hollywood. You are capable of having the life you deserve. All of us believe that. Even if with only 1% of our beings, or 5 or 10%. But there is some part of us that tells us we deserve to have happiness, because we all want to get off the ride when it's not fun anymore. We handwrote those letters, and of course I decorated the heck out of the letter and the envelope with drawings and stickers, as one does. Getting away from the everyday on that retreat gave me the time and space I desperately needed to focus on reality. It was a fat camp I'd always wanted to attend. Who doesn't want to go to some place where they can be with a lot of people dealing with the same thing? It was heaven. On the way home, I was thinking about how lovely it was that this guy offered me a ticket. He didn't even know me. Oh, I thought, that's the universe. I am supposed to be doing this. About 2 months in, I was clocking daily meetings and still hadn't spoken when my friend suggested that I start. "Maybe there's something you want to talk about," he said. "Oh, I don't know," I replied. Translation, "Nope, I'm good." He knew I was scared, so he put on his fake lecture tone. "There's something really powerful about getting it off your chest in a group setting," he said. "Maybe others have gone through the same, and perhaps they can give you some good advice."
"Okay, all right, all right, all right."
It's funny because in real life, I hold court and I tell stories for days. I'm an actress. And in the room, I was all, "Please don't pay attention to me. I don't want to talk about this. This is too hard." But I decided it wasn't about me. Hearing a new person's story helps those farther along remember their early days when they couldn't stop eating and didn't know why. Now I just had to talk. There were plenty of people dying to get things off their chests that day, so I let them go first. Meanwhile, my friend was across the room alternating between giving me encouraging, "Okay, now you," smiles, and shooting daggers. Finally, I started to talk. And I honestly don't remember what I said that first time. I'm sure it had something to do with work and how miserable I was. I was continually asked to do more and more work, but I didn't have any support. It was hard finding a balance between work and marriage. There are women who work incredible hours and then come home and cook and nurture their families. I wasn't one of those women. I think that became an issue with Marty, too. It's not that Marty had been coddled, but his mother took care of him and his dad. Maybe as a man he wanted to be taken care of. But the fact is that he worked 4 or 5 hours a day. My feeling was, if I'm going to do all this to support your writing, you shouldn't have a problem cooking dinner or doing a load of laundry. On top of that, I couldn't help having resentment about our financial situation. I was working so hard but had nothing to show for it. Being tired all the time made all these issues easy to brush aside. When I thought about all my frustrations, I reminded myself what a supportive person my husband was. We truly loved each other and very deeply. He tried to help me do music on the weekends, and just because I needed a creative outlet. He had done music engineering in the UK, and he could help me write lyrics. He would mix different pieces of music together, getting samples from old school songs, and we would try to collaborate. We had fun, but it can be hard to be creative with your significant other, because if you can't even discuss pizza toppings, you may be afraid to tell him you don't like something he's added to the song that you're working on. There was that. But we still had a lot of fun, and I was grateful. Marty never said anything about the support group meetings, but the longer I did them, the clearer it was that he didn't like them. I was putting myself first and figuring out the true nature of my relationship with food in the past. And moving forward, I didn't notice how neglected Marty was feeling. He started to exercise even more, and Marty lost enough weight that his wedding ring no longer fit. Whenever I mentioned getting it resized, he told me he'd get around to it. He mainly exercised by taking hikes near our apartment during the day. He hiked in the afternoon, after working mornings at a small PR firm. Because I didn't hike with him, he ended up finding someone in his office to hike with, Betty. I admit, I was not initially fond of Betty. Marty had talked about this woman at work who was cool, but I didn't think much of it. She was married and she had kids. But one night, Marty and I were walking around the Galleria Mall when this woman suddenly yelled in our direction, "Martini!" It was Betty, with her husband. Martini was her pet name for Marty. "Hold on," I thought. Hold on. This grown-ass woman with a husband and children just called my husband by a nickname? Who is this bitch? Later, Marty assured me there was nothing to worry about and proceeded to tell me all this personal stuff that she had confided in him. Medical things and personal information that you might not want to tell your own husband, much less my husband. One day, I left work early because I had an audition. There is about one decent role for a plus-size woman a year, which meant this was my yearly audition. I went home first to change my shirt and pick up my headshot. Driving up, I saw Marty pulling into the garage. I remember my exact thought was, "Oh, cool, he's gonna go hike," but I still get to say hello to him. Then a car that was parked out front just peeled away, going way faster than you would expect in our little residential area. It was Betty's car. That was weird, I thought. I didn't think it was suspicious. It was just weird. Hey, was that Betty? I asked when I went in. Yeah, we're gonna go hiking, he said, sitting on the couch. Why did she speed away? I don't know, he said it like a question. He's not a liar. He's not an actor. He really didn't know. Does she feel guilty that she's hiking with you? I asked. That she didn't expect me to be here? Well, we were gonna smoke together. Smoke weed? I said. And then, like, hike? Yeah. If I smoked out, I couldn't even walk, much less hike. But then I thought, why is another woman in my house without me? And the two of you are getting high together? Okay. Okay. You have to understand this is a weird relationship, I said. She calls you Martini. You guys go hiking together. You know her personal information. Let's put the shoe on the other foot. What if there was some guy at work who called me some nickname like Christmas? Christmas? Let's say Christmas, I said. And we went hiking together and we spent all this time together. Oh, yeah, he said slowly. That would bother me. Uh-huh, I said. So what the hell? I get it. That was not my goal. I mean, I know you weren't going to smoke out on the damn trail. I get it if you're going to do that. You do it here. But it doesn't make me feel good. I felt guilty for being mad at him. I knew in my heart Marty was such a good man that he would never, ever cheat on me. I didn't think he was even having an emotional affair. But I just kept replaying that vision of her racing off. She was in my house while I was at work. And I wouldn't even have known about it if I didn't have an audition. And no, I didn't get the job. The guilt didn't leave me. I was trying so hard to get a hold of my relationship with my body and break my habit of eating my emotions and of equating food with sharing love. I didn't know how to spend time with Marty without using. My friend ended up leaving the program. He wasn't doing well and we lost touch. I got close to another person who I love, but then she stopped coming to group too. Huh? What does it all mean, I asked myself, if people keep leaving? Seeing that made me question everything. I was losing weight, but was I getting addicted to going to group? And if my friends eventually gave up, what would stop me from doing the same? A thin woman approached me after our group session ended and asked if I wanted to partner with her. Our agreement was that I would email her with what I was planning to eat for breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snack. Then I would give her a report in the evening about how things had gone. It was going well, but she was a little tougher than I had hoped. We did this for 3 months when she said something that did me in. You know, Chrissy, she said, we all know that you're in pain by the way that you dress. She thought I dressed inappropriately for my size and that my clothes were too tight. I know you focus on your face because I did the same thing. You don't want anyone to look at your body. Damn. I was so confused by what she had said that I talked to a couple people in the group. One told me, just because she's kept the weight off doesn't mean she's done with her issues, because we're all dealing with this stuff. This was a time when I was trying to feel comfortable in my body, no matter what I was wearing. Maybe it made her uncomfortable to see me feeling so comfortable. Did she think that fat was such a bad thing that she couldn't accept it on anybody? That I was supposed to hide? I couldn't get past it, and her words hurt me so much that I was discouraged from continuing in the group. I stopped going and I decided I had learned enough to go it alone. But deep down, I knew I was making an excuse so that he didn't have to go back and face her. Slowly, Marty and I fell back into old habits. I managed to keep the weight off for a while, but then the pounds started to come back. More important than any number was the fact that I had returned to my old crutch of numbing myself with food. It started with having a little bit more here and there, but it's a slippery slope. One night I treated myself to a cheeseburger and fries. That became a weekly thing, and then more often. I would get busy and decide the best use of my time would be to just run through the drive-thru, or I would have salty food and say, well, now I need sweet. Sometimes you don't realize you're eating the feelings you can't handle. One day I came home to find the letter I had written to myself. Sherry had kept her promise to mail it a year later to the day. It was trippy to see that letter arrive in the mail. I had completely forgotten about it. I opened it right away. "You are capable of having the life you deserve," I read. I was glad that I had lost the weight and kept it off for a while, but I knew I was slipping. Is this ever going to change? I asked myself. When they scare you with statistics such as 95% of people who lose weight gain it back, it's easy to feel hopeless. And I did. I decided I made a mistake leaving the program. That was on the long list of mistakes I began to create. I was so excited to receive the letter, but it opened a Pandora's box of guilt and blame. I had to get comfortable with being uncomfortable again. I needed to recommit, if not to finding another support group, to at least putting my health and myself first. Marty's parents came to visit every summer for a month. It always coincided with June gloom, the time when LA has cloudy, overcast skies and cooler temperatures. His parents would sleep on our pull-out couch, and I would play tour guide. Marty or I would drive them everywhere, and I would plan excursions such as a trip to Las Vegas one year and Santa Barbara the next. This year, they were set to arrive on a day that I had a long-scheduled lunch with a friend, and I was going to have lunch with my friend. I apologized that I couldn't have lunch with Marty's parents, but I took them to Target and promised that we'd have plenty of together time in the month they'd be in town. That night, Marty seemed off. We were in our bedroom when I finally asked him, "What's going on with you?" "Nothing," he said.
"Okay."
"I can't believe that you would desert my parents," he said. "You are more concerned with having lunch with your friends. You don't even do the laundry on the weekend. You don't cook." Marty launched into a list of grievances. I don't know if his parents said something about me leaving them or if he just felt like I wasn't acting like the wife they envisioned for him. I just knew he was mad. And so was I. "Do your parents understand that I work sometimes 80 hours a week and you work part-time so you can do your screenwriting?" I said. "Do your parents understand any of that?" I felt so bad just putting it out there, but I wanted to get the facts straight. He left the room. I had asked him what was going on with him, and I had my answer. "Oh, there's a lot going on, Chrissy," I said to myself. We waited to speak about it until his parents left. Meanwhile, we pretended nothing was wrong. It all came out at the night of a birthday party for my friend's boyfriend. He invited us out, and Marty alluded to not wanting to go. "You don't have to go," I said, "but you are my husband and people are going to ask where you are. And it will be weird if you don't come, because you've been to so many other events with these people." "Well, hanging out with actors is exhausting," he said. "They're narcissistic and selfish. They make it all about themselves and they talk over each other." I wondered if Marty was really trying to say how he felt about me. He did come to the restaurant for the birthday dinner, and we had a miserable time. I could tell he wanted to be anywhere but there, and that he felt everything I did was wrong. We barely spoke driving home. When we got home, I sat on one end of the couch, and he sat on the other. "Are you unhappy?" I asked. "Something's going on." He didn't say a word. I was calm, but I felt this whirling inside of me. This was really happening. "Why don't you get your ring fixed so you can wear it?" I asked. "You could just get it resized." "You can take time to spend weeks going through entire record stores to find the most obscure rap album ever created by man or woman, but you can't find somebody to size your ring for you? You don't want to. Obviously, you don't want to wear it." "No, that's not true. I'm fine." "No, you're not," I said. "If you don't want to be with me, why don't you just tell me? I'm not an idiot. There's something wrong and you're not telling me." "What are you talking about? Everything is about you," he said. "Chrissy, you are as narcissistic as you are selfish. From the very beginning, everything has been about you." It felt like a slap. "From the beginning?" "Yes. Well, if you've always been that unhappy," I said, "we should probably not be together anymore. Maybe we should just separate." "How can you be so clinical about all this?" "You don't want to be with me. That's the bottom line. I know you don't." "What? You're being so critical and I have apparently made you miserable for, like, years? That's not right." I reached for my support group language. You need to examine that and your feeling of worthiness because it what, Christy, what? It takes two to tango, I finally said. Well, I don't want to separate, he said. Will you go to counseling? I asked. No, it's too American. And there was my answer. I didn't know how to be married, apparently, and now I had to learn how to be separated. In the moment, I thought, oh, now I have to tell everybody that we're getting separated. But then I realized that it didn't matter. Real failure would be staying in a relationship that made us miserable. But for Marty, he'd come across the world, married this woman, and he felt like a failure. I tried to tell him that, even through all the pain, it doesn't matter what everybody else thinks. It matters how you feel in your life and in your happiness. I wanted to at least do a better job at being an ex-wife than I did as a wife. We moved out of the apartment we were renting and into separate places. You have the TV, I'll take the couches. And so it went. Just after Marty and I separated, Grams got very sick. We were told she had leukemia and that she didn't have long to live. I flew to Florida to be with her just as my California life was dissolving. I didn't tell her about Marty. I knew she would worry, and I wanted that time to be about her and holding her hand. I couldn't process losing her and losing Marty at the same time. Are you sure you're okay, honey? She asked me. I'm fine, I said. I am so fine to be sitting here with you. So fine. That was also my answer to my family. Though I told them we were separating. We're friends, I said. And that part was true. I'm fine. That part, not so much. I didn't ask my mom for advice on how to handle the separation. I was afraid to ask what she really thought because I didn't want to hear that she had known something I didn't. I was already feeling bad enough about becoming another statistic. I just said to myself, figure it out, Chrissy. When Grams passed, I just never wanted to accept it. I think I'm still in denial that she's not a phone call away. I held it together at the funeral until we sang. The song was on Eagle's Wings, her favorite hymn, which became mine from my lonely Sundays going to church as a teen. We had to move our belongings out of her home, so my sisters and I went over to help my mom. She wanted me to have some of Graham's costume jewelry, but the thing that means the most to me is Graham's Maybelline eyeliner that I took. It's just so her, and I'm never giving it up. I regret that she died before I was in a position to help her financially. I would have loved to help her buy a home with a washer and dryer that would have made her life so much easier. She lived on her own or with us for the 30 years she was separated from my grandfather. There must have been so many times she felt adrift. Now it was my turn, and I wanted to handle the divorce in the most caring, healthy way possible. Marty and I went to the notary public together for the divorce paperwork. Under fluorescent lights, we sat across from each other and signed the papers. And we both cried, sad about the end. We are friends and text regularly. He's still writing and lives in Los Angeles. He has moved on. Recently, after we'd been divorced 4.5 years, he admitted one regret. I'm sorry that we didn't try counseling, he said. Okay, I said. Me too. He's really such a wonderful human being that people ask me, would you ever get back with him? We're just not the right fit, but I love him, and I'm always checking in on him. I'm still working on my goal of being a better ex-wife than I was a wife. When I share my story, people sometimes wait for the, ugh, him. It will never come. Marty is such a great guy, and I am grateful that we had our time together. If you do hate your ex, I'd like you to consider the damage you might be doing to yourself. Look, I have heard some horror stories from my girlfriends. Things I would never tell my friends to just forgive and forget. But I think you can focus on letting go of hating someone first, and then forgive the person on your own time. Because carrying hate is a heavy load, but offering forgiveness is freeing. Be mindful, my new vows. When my relationship with my husband ended, I had to remove my ego from the equation and just ask, what was my part in that? My ex told me that I was narcissistic and selfish. That was really, really hard for me to process because I always thought that I was the opposite. I wasn't confident enough to even think about being selfish. I had to evaluate what I was lacking and not understanding about myself and how I could make things better in my next relationship. Therefore, I made a few vows. 1. It's just a towel. I vow to really sit with my feelings and not be impulsive in communicating them. If someone I care about leaves a wet towel on the floor of the bathroom instead of hanging it up, my first instinct is to complain about it. I need to look at why it bothers me. Is it because my mom ingrained in me that I was supposed to hang up the wet towel or I'd be in trouble? Perhaps I'm projecting that on him. Or is the towel somehow representative of other things I've asked him to do that he didn't follow through on? And so this is the safe way to vent? Maybe I simply don't want to have wet towels on the floor. Hey, it's wet, I could say calmly, without all this baggage. Can you just hang it up? 2, get down off the cross. The whole idea that you suffer for love just doesn't work. Who wants to be around that? I vow to put myself first and get down off the cross. I'm not saying you don't compromise or choose battles, but you should be willing to put yourself first so you don't burn out. 3, ask and receive. I pledge to communicate my needs and my wants and have the wisdom to know the difference and the self-worth to ask for both. That is hard because you might find yourself thinking, am I greedy? Am I unrealistic? Yes, if you expect a diamond ring every month. Okay, that's ridiculous. But if it's a routine date night or having a shared activity that you do for fun, let your partner know. Because if you don't tell your partner what will make you happy, you are unfairly holding that person responsible for failing to give it to you. And when your partner gives you something, whether it's time, love, or something material, acknowledge it and tell him or her why it makes you happy. Ask for information. You can say, if you're feeling a certain way, I'd love to talk about it. Don't say, I can tell you're mad at me. Because maybe it's not about you. I know, preposterous, right? Let your partner decide how he or she feels and give your partner the space to think about how to present his or her facts, which leads to 4, just the facts. Let's say you ask someone to take out the trash and every day you come home to a full can. Don't say, that makes me feel, nope, keep the feelings out of it and state the issue without emotion. I did the laundry last week and I needed help with the trash. That's the facts, honey. And way more effective than, I do everything around here and I ask you to do one simple thing. That one always leads to a fight. 5, he's not my best friend, he's my boyfriend. My friend Donnie and I were twin souls in a former life because we are so alike. He's the person who annoys me so much when we're together that I want to punch him in his face, but I still love him and want him around me. I can't expect that a boyfriend is going to act like Donnie. First, Donnie's a gentleman who prefers gentlemen. Second, as my best friend, Donnie can read my mind. With my boyfriends, I prefer to keep a little mystery. 6, repeat after me. Please, God, let me come from a place of love. Something happens when you say those words out loud. Something shifts, and you can think about your intention in any interaction. Whenever you have an issue in a relationship, whether it be with a loved one or a family member, just check yourself and make sure you're coming from a place of love. Because you love this person, right? Your core impulse is to love, so honor that. And don't drown it out with too much talk. This can be scary, because once you realize all anyone wants is to be loved and respected, then you realize that you have to look at rivals, enemies, coworkers, anyone, really, from a place of love. That's work, but it's totally worth it. 7, just try. When I was married, I was so afraid of trying new things. I didn't even want to cook for fear that my husband wasn't going to like what I made. If that happened, I would just fall apart because here I was exhausted from work and I had set aside time and anyway. But if I had flipped that around and Marty cooked me dinner or planned a date for me, wouldn't that have made me happy? Whenever I think of anyone taking time to do something for me, what I cherish is not the actual thing, but the thought and intention that went into it. This fear of trying extends to overtures of affection. I don't just mean sex. I mean looking someone in the eye and saying why you are in it to win it with that person. Why you want to share this life with that person. Our ego gets in the way and tells us that we look cheesy at best, and at worst, the affection will not be returned. No one wants to experience the emotional version of being left hanging in a high five. But trust me, if you put yourself out there, chances are your feelings will be reciprocated, or at least received with kindness. 11. When you're so thirsty, you're dehydrated. Right after my divorce, it felt like every man I spoke to was interested in flirting with me, which was ironic because I thought that I was completely unlovable after Marty and I broke up. These guys did not treat me the way I wanted or deserved to be treated, but sometimes we want people to like us even if we don't like them. Whether it was my thirst or theirs, it was real. At that time in my life, it was like I was in a romantic comedy that was way more comedy than romance. Nowadays, when my girlfriends and I start trading stories about the men we've dated, hooked up with, or dodged, I always win when it comes to the most outrageous. And if I've had enough cocktails, I will even tell the toilet story. Oh, dear God. Now, I'll share some of my finest dating moments with you. You've been warned. The sneaky sneaker salesman. There was this one guy I met at a sports shop, and we flirted as he helped me try on sneakers. He was really cute, with an olive complexion and dark hair. He took me to the register to ring me up. If you need any more help with anything, he said, just pop in. You went above and beyond, I said, thinking, okay, cute. As he went to hand me my receipt, he said, do you need this? No, I'm good. Then can you write your number on it and give it to me? Oh, I said. Oh, okay. Playa. He started texting me right away and was very nice, but something gave me the feeling he was in a relationship. I knew he at least had a son. Plus, the receipt move? Ugh. He had that down on lock, and that takes practice. The more I got to know him, the more the red flags started popping up. Plus, he would text a lot, then stop suddenly, and then out of nowhere start again. But did I mention he was as cute as I was lonely? Yeah, there was that. When he returned from another one of his texting sabbaticals, I had to get a message like, hey, sexy. Nope, I would say, staring at the phone. This isn't okay. Then I would text him right back. I was so, as my friends and I say, thirsty. For attention. Dehydrated kind of thirsty. Even as I typed out some flirty response, I would think, Chrissy, he doesn't deserve your time. What are you doing? The store where he worked was near my house, so I went there multiple times to browse, but I was browsing for him. I pictured running into him and planned exactly what I would say. Wow, so weird. I didn't think you were going to be here. Thank God he never was. It was not cute. It looked like I was casing the joint on some recon mission. Hiding behind the damn soccer shin guards. Since I never saw him, I called the store. I know, the worst. A woman answered, and I asked if I could speak to him. He actually got transferred to the Santa Clarita store, she said flatly, like maybe she'd gotten this call a couple times. Oh, thank you, I said, sounding distracted like I was a bill collector crossing off a lead. Have a good day, I thought to myself. That's a 30-minute drive. Okay, but that was way too much even for me at the time. Honey, if you think you're humming Desperado, now wait for this. I did that thing you do when you act like you meant to text someone else. Wait, you haven't done that? Anyway, I texted him as if I were replying to someone asking me out. Yeah, I'm available on Tuesday night. I waited a minute before typing. Oh, so sorry that wasn't for you. The bait worked, and we started texting again. Now I look back, and I see this woman who had so much to offer somebody, and she was lurking in a sports store and doing Scooby-Doo shenanigans to get a text back. Desperation and boredom will do that to you. I finally stopped texting him back, but only once I had another guy interested. Like I said, the thirst was real. The one who ran away, literally. I dated a guy for a minute who was sort of afraid for us to be seen together. So, I'll let that sink in. This was a few years ago, so don't judge me. By the way, he's the one that hit on me, I will have you know. We're in the same industry, and we are both at an event. I just finished talking to a friend when this tall, thin guy came up to me. Hi, he said. Hey there, I said. He told me his name. I know who you are, I said. And I'm not ashamed to say I looked him up and down. He is sexy and a former athlete. But I didn't think he was coming on to me. It's not that I just assume no man ever wants to hit on me. It's just that I didn't think it was happening here. Have you eaten dinner? He asked. That seemed like such an odd question. Why would he care? Yeah, I ate before I came, I said. Oh, okay, he said, adding after a pause as he moved closer. Well, maybe I should take you to dinner sometime. Yeah, sure, whatever, I said. That is literally what I said. Don't tell me I don't got game. He took out his phone to take my number, and I saw kids on the home screen. Oh, you're married with kids, I said. How cute. No, I'm divorced with kids. And that's not uncommon in L.A., so that wasn't a disqualifier. Our first date was fun, and he was charismatic. We had a good time, and we laughed a lot. But he seemed aggressive. And I'm very particular about that. I have enough aggressiveness to show interest and go in for the kiss, but don't assume I'm going to kiss you back. I want you to want to kiss me, but not be angry if I don't kiss you. That's just gross. It turned out he was, let's just say, a selfish lover. And nobody wants that. I didn't take him seriously because I'm not fantasizing about getting serious with a selfish lover. Thank you very much. Still, we kept seeing each other and hooking up. We enjoyed each other's company and liked the same movies and shows, so dating him was just kind of something to do. I was on sexual autopilot. Then one day, we were on the couch at his place, and out of the blue, he told me, you know, I'm not over my ex-girlfriend. Oh, okay, I said, totally nonplussed. Honestly, this was a no-strings thing, so I took it as him saying, yeah, I can't eat shellfish. I simply replied, oh, don't worry, it's not like I want to be in a relationship. His head kind of cocked. Oh, okay, he said, but I could tell he didn't believe me. Okay, I said, nodding my head and seeing his one cocked head with two raised eyebrows. Boo-boo, ain't nobody said they want to be in a relationship here. And to repeat, he was also a bit of a selfish lover. I'm not sitting at home writing Mrs. Selfish Lover over and over in my diary. We saw each other a couple times for a bite, and that was fun. But then one time we stopped at the grocery store on the way to his house. As soon as we got inside, he started walking way ahead of me. When I caught up, he would move left. If I moved to the left, he'd shift right over to the right. Those athlete skills were coming in handy. It's one thing to say, I'm just going to go to the chip aisle, be right back. But I knew exactly what he was doing. This mother, I said under my breath. I was pissed. This guy was ashamed to be seen with me. We were driving my car. And did I mention we were driving my car because his ass didn't have one? I should have told him to Uber home from Whole Foods. And you know what I did? I parked the car at his place and sat there waiting for him to get out. What's wrong? He said. Without making eye contact, I said, nothing. Sure, this was no strings, but it occurred to me I'd never met a single one of his friends, and he had made it clear that our hooking up wasn't something he really wanted to tell anybody about. I'd been fine with it at the time, but it suddenly seemed kind of twisted, like he was ashamed to be seen with me. Fuck that. I wanted to bolt, and he could tell. I deserved better than a man who was ashamed of me. No, really, he pressed. What's wrong? I just think it's kind of shitty how you treated me in the grocery store. I don't know what you're talking about, he said in that exasperated lying voice men use when they know exactly what you're talking about. Okay, I think I'm gonna go home. He called me a couple of times after that night, and I ignored him. Finally, I relented. His opening line was, "I don't want you to feel I was doing anything intentionally."
Okay. But you were.
You were embarrassed to be seen with me. Even if you were subconsciously embarrassed, it was a